Chapter 11. The medicine drew Maynard deeper into the fire's rhythm. The stories it kept, the spirits of the grandfathers and their grandfathers and theirs that danced in its flicker. He breathed the essence of sage and cedar, and his heart beat in time with the water drum, and the flames died down, then leapt again through the night, and the moon made its way across the desert sky. Lou Malia had remained in touch with Robbie Romero since signing him at Island Records in 1989. Robbie was no stranger to the Native American church. He'd grown up participating in its ceremonies with his mother and had been reintroduced to them through Reuben A. Snake, church spokesperson and national chairman of the American Indian Movement. A sun dancer and pipe carrier, Robbie was plenty familiar with the sundown to sunrise journey of healing and spiritual transformation. Robbie was not, though, familiar with Tool, but that didn't lessen his sense of obligation when Malia inquired about his bringing Maynard to the reservation. "I wanted to do it for Lou and for Maynard," Robbie would recall. "I remembered what Reuben had told me, that if someone reaches out and it's appropriate, you should always help them." And on a day in midsummer, Robbie's assistant met Maynard at the airport in Albuquerque and drove him across the desert, past sagebrush and cactus and mesas orange at the horizon, ever deeper into the Indian territories and the Diné Reservation. Taking part in a peyote ceremony, Maynard quickly discovered, wasn't quite as simple as booking a seat in the teepee. Before the ceremony proper, he must ready himself through the purification ritual that would detoxify his body of impurities and cleanse his spirit, too, of anger and fear, greed and negativity. The sweat lodge sat at the edge of the reservation, a squat rounded structure no bigger than an animal's lair or a child's snow fort, far too small, Maynard could tell, for a man to move about inside without stooping. The dome was formed of bent saplings and covered with tarps, and represented, he learned, the womb of the Great Mother, a dark cocoon he'd enter and from which he'd emerge, or so the legends had it, reborn. Late in the afternoon, Maynard and Robbie and the roadmen who would guide them along the peyote road crawled inside on hands and knees and took their places in a circle. The entrance was closed off, and the only light was the red glow of the heated rocks stacked in the circle's center. It didn't take long for the lodge to grow as hot and steamy as any sauna. Darkness and drumbeats and prayers and the tickle of sweat down his back were the whole world, and time became a concept Maynard could barely remember. Hours later, or minutes, the closeness and the heat and the glowing rocks and the rhythmic drumming became at last overwhelming, and he crawled out into the desert and knelt there, and the scorpion tattoo across his back glistened with sweat. In time, he scuttled across the sand and back inside, determined to remain on this path and discover where it might lead, however strange its course. He knew that to change his mind now was out of the question. Already, he recognized that his presence was as crucial a part of the ceremony as the words of the blessings, as the precise placement of rocks in the fire pit. "You're not a passenger, and you're not a voyeur," he would explain. "From the time you show up, it's all-encompassing. It's not like you buy a ticket and come for the show. You participate in this event and help to create it." The next day, the group moved farther into the desert, to a secluded spot at some remove from the village. Maynard lay long wooden poles on the ground, helped bind them with thick rope, hoisted them until they leaned in perfect balance one against the other, and wrapped thick canvas over the framework. He stepped back. The teepee stood strong and tall against the evening sky. The desert was empty but for figures he watched approach from all directions. Chiefs and elders, roadmen, a medicine woman and a grandmother, a drummer, people of the Diné and Apache and Pueblo nations, Robbie's children. Each came for reasons of their own, and came too to walk beside the others in the communal journey. Now they sat in a circle upon the ground, a family gathered to share green chili, bread baked that afternoon by women of the reservation, corn grown in the nearby fields, mutton from the tribe's Navajo Churro flock.
The whole thing was a sobering experience after going through what I had for the last few years. People kiss your ass because you're in a band and they think they can get something from you. You get all this attention. But the elders and the sacred dancer and the kids don't give a fuck about your rock star status. And that was very liberating. You're back to being where you can see the struggle on the struggle's level, where you have to prove yourself or not. Some of these people might not even like you, but you have to be okay with that. You can't expect to be treated differently from everybody else.
Stars appeared one by one in the darkening sky. Bowls and cups and thermoses were packed away in baskets and backpacks, and the teepee glowed, backlit by the setting sun. Maynard took his place in the queue and filed inside with the others. They circled the fire, replicating the movements of the planets around Father Sun. The roadman welcomed them, and welcomed the spirits of the ancestors, too, that would sit beside them in the circle until morning. The roadman blessed the medicine with cedar smoke and passed it around the circle, fresh peyote buttons and dried amber peyote tea. The medicine might bring deep introspection or unexpected insight, heightened perception or strange visions, but Maynard's hours in the dark sweat lodge had left him trusting of the will of the peyote spirit, and whatever it might bring, he accepted the sacrament when it was offered.
I wasn't a stranger to that sort of thing, but over the years, when I did partake, I respected as much as I could that altered state. You have to honor it. You're there for a reason. It's not about getting fucked up. You're signing off on this thing as a spiritual journey. You're not going to do peyote and all of a sudden come up with a new theory of relativity. Well, maybe you will, but if you do, I think it's in you already. The reason you do this is to take a lateral step to the right or the left and look at things from a different perspective. You do it to become aware of something you should already know, but might have missed it because you were looking at it from the wrong angle.
Each element of the ceremony, every gesture, every object handed from one to the other around the circle held its story. Its form, its choreography, was determined by nothing less than the laws of geometry. The teepee poles angled to form its conical shape. The entrance, situated to face due east. The peyote blessed and the sacred songs sung. 1, 2, 3, 4 times. Once for each of the four directions, the four elements. The circles echoed the unbroken connection of all things. The balance of body, mind, and spirit, of fire, water, and medicine, were triads sturdy in their grace. And when the flames burned low, the firekeeper brought branches to feed the fire and meticulously arranged them to form a V, its apex pointing toward the center of the crescent moon altar. "Maynard knows that we become what we think," Robbie would explain. "He understands it's not what we do, it's the way we do it." The rituals created a pattern, a rhythmic clockwork repetition through the night of songs and prayers and drumming, each step pitching Maynard from the familiar and shepherding him further into the new way of seeing and an awareness of his part in the equation. When it was his turn, he smoked from the sacred smoke. He accepted the gourd rattle from Robbie, took midnight water from the drinking cup, then passed it to the grandmother beside him. The roadmen spoke their healing prayers. The people shared their stories, their own and those of the ancestors, and each telling created another dimension of the eternal tale. The flames flickered in counterpoint to the jangling rattles, the pulse of the water drums, and the songs. They cast shadows against the walls of the teepee, and told the fire's story all night long. The women and children drew back the flap from the entrance and brought dried meat and wild berries and fresh water from the river. And Maynard stepped into morning. The desert was still. The desert crackled with life. Across the lightening sky winged 7 blackbirds as if placed there by design. In the distance, mountains rose against the horizon, sharp and distinct as his own attentiveness. He stood in just that place, the sand cold under his bare feet. From somewhere quite nearby, or far, a cactus wren rasped its daybreak song. Beneath a cluster of prickly pear, a horned toad stirred, and the morning star shone in the east. "I think the ceremony had a profound impact on him," Robbie would recall. "After a ceremony, a different spiritual life begins. We respect and maintain that life. What Maynard experienced allowed his spirit to touch the beauty and power of our people. He got to experience medicine in a respectful way, in a good way, in the way the Creator intended." Maynard's night in the teepee had brought no revelations, or none that he would afterward recall. He'd seen no visions, received no otherworldly advice, and there was no telling what prayer, which word, which blessing would be the one he'd remember always. The journey had been an extended, concentrated moment, a path that opened to the mirror image of discord and anger, opened to a rhythm, a harmony. That was all. At the end of the path was morning, a morning not so different from those when he'd looked up from his notebook at the surprise of gray dawn and discovered he'd created in the night a song where once there had been silence. "What you see is a validation," he would explain. "But it's not a coupon you can go cash in. It's not a sign. It's just a nod. It's the universe nodding, and you're part of that. There's no possible way to explain it to somebody who wasn't there. And you know what? It's okay. You don't have to. You see it, you nod back, and you move on." Anima had been certified gold 10 weeks after its release, and by the time the tour ended, was well on its way to reaching double platinum. The album had been a 1998 Grammy nominee for Best Recording Package, and had come away with the award for its title track. Royalties had at last offset the zoo advance, and nearly 7 years after releasing its first album, Tool had begun to see a financial return. Steady paychecks, Maynard realized, meant his days of roommates and substandard apartments could be a thing of the past. "The goal is not the money," he would explain. "Money is just gas in the tank to be able to do the things you love." During a break in the tour schedule, he'd discovered a rent-to-own house on the outskirts of Jerome, a modest 1.5-bedroom on a southwest-facing slope overlooking the valley and Mingus Mountain. Here, just outside the city limits, he could trade the evening gown and high-heeled slippers for bib overalls and work boots and transform his acre into terraced gardens. It would take some research to determine which plants would actually thrive on the rugged hillside. This was not the black loam of Mike's peony and daylily plots, but a gravelly, sandy caliche co-mixed with lime and calcium. And the climate might present an agricultural challenge or two as well. He'd experienced the heat of a Jerome summer, and locals had told him of frost on the mountain as early as October, and in some years as late as May Day. But the little house would be the quiet retreat he needed, the home where he could build Lego cities with Devo, and at Christmas time stack books about Native American history under the tree for him. And not far away were Main Street and the Flatiron Cafe, where already Maynard was a welcome regular. And an hour distant, Prescott, the progressive college town offering, he was pleased to learn, periodic sessions of Melchizedek's Flower of Life seminar. Eager as he was to settle into life on the mountain, he must, for the time being at least, divide his time between Jerome and his Tool responsibilities in L.A., and he took up temporary residence at the Lameda House, where Billy was busy at work on music of his own. And the arrangement worked out fortuitously for Mike. He and Jan had parted ways, and now he would live in the orchard house across the road and watch over the Jerome house while he enjoyed his retirement years on the hiking and skiing trails of Arizona.
For the first couple years after I moved, I spent more time in airports and tour bus than I did in Jerome. And after the Anima tour, I still had to rehearse and record with the band. Nowadays, you can open up your laptop and record an album in your living room, wherever you are. But back then, all the equipment and studios were in L.A. You'd have to rent mics and cables, and end up spending twice as much if you tried to record an album in the middle of Arizona.
Before work on a fourth album commenced in earnest, Maynard took advantage of his time in L.A. He joined Laura on the Tantrum stage in their Country Boner act, and with a renewed enthusiasm, revisited the acting lessons he'd begun when he'd first come to the city. It was par for the course, he'd learned, for sitcom stars and singers and sports figures to branch into films, their success in one discipline paving their way to another. If ever he were to follow that path, he'd need to up his performance level. By now a master of disguise, he enrolled at the Ivana Chubbuck Studio on Melrose as only James, and came to class in worn leather jackets and jeans, ostensibly just one more unknown with no expectations of special treatment or intention of riding his own coattails to cinematic success. "I busted my ass in that class," he would recall. He struggled with breathing exercises and cold readings, confronted his weaknesses, and tried his best to play to what he imagined his strengths should be. In his attempt to master Chubbuck's 12 steps to character development, as actors Eddie McClintock and David Spade had done before him, he all but ignored his natural comedic talents. And when class was dismissed, he returned to the LaMeda house discouraged, frustrated by the challenge that seemed only a chore. A month into the course, Maynard's concerned coach took him aside. "He said he thought he knew what my problem was," Maynard remembered. "He felt that I was absolutely terrified that I was average." He knew at once that his coach was onto something. Despite Undertow's platinum status, despite the awards and reviews and sold-out arenas, Maynard still harbored the suspicion that one day his past would surely catch up with him. The spotlights and applause would be revealed as the illusion they were, and he'd come face to face with his true destiny, that of a complacent factory worker nursing forgotten dreams and Bud Light in a gray Ohio living room. "I felt I had to always be one step ahead so I could say I did something before that happened," he would recall. His greatest challenge at the Chubbuck Studio wouldn't be earning an A, but outdistancing the echo of dismissal and underestimation, the irrational and persistent belief in his mediocrity. And the course did little to encourage the pace he'd need to maintain if he were to reach either goal.
Every week we were assigned a partner. We were supposed to meet with them during the week and develop a scene and present it to the class. I kept getting stuck with these actresses or models who just couldn't be bothered to study with me. I was there for like 2, maybe 3 months, and only did 3 scenes because these people kept cutting class to go to auditions or photo shoots. It was a waste of time to be there and not be able to exercise whatever the fuck it was I had to exercise.
But at the Gracie studio, he had only to rely on himself. Jiu-jitsu wasn't a tandem effort. He needn't depend on a partner to earn an above-average score. "It's up to you to work hard," he would explain. "If you're getting your ass kicked every time, you're not getting any better. There's no coasting in jiu-jitsu." Success was a matter of avoiding the head-on attack, of stepping to a more advantageous position to alter the very dynamic of the game, of diverting his opponent's energy and redirecting his own. If your opponent is driving all his weight on you, you move to the side and let it go into the ground or into the wall, he said, instead of trying to push back. "I learned to step outside the situation." In hotel rooms and airline terminals from Fresno to Newcastle, Maynard had used his downtime during the Anima tour to work on new songs, songs more complex, more metaphoric than ever. But a contract dispute with Zoo's successor, Volcano Entertainment, had stalled progress on the next album, and by early 1999, The legal disputes had left the band's creativity blocked, and Maynard feeling restless. "Things weren't moving as fast as I'd like," he would recall. "What was I supposed to do now? Sit around the house rereading all these depositions? That's boring. I felt like I wasn't doing enough."
"I knew I had more to offer than the timing of Tool would allow. More songs, more music, more art. I come from a background of people who couldn't do any of those things. They couldn't be in one band, let alone three. They couldn't add up the monthly bills or even dress themselves. If you have the means, the knowledge to create something and you don't, shame on you. If you're able to be good at your job, to raise a child, to plant a garden, whatever, it's your responsibility to do it. Not only for yourself, but for the world."
Billy Howerdell had his own portfolio of partially completed music, a sort of post-punk, dark-wave hybrid he'd spent years tweaking and editing and polishing. He'd never considered the possibility of his songs one day making the Billboard charts, or being produced for that matter. His art was a solitary exercise in craft and composition, a challenge to create with his portable four-track recorder, a sonic layering of orchestral movement and heavy metal. "It happened one day that Maynard walked in while I was working," he recalled in a 2015 interview. "I played him one of my songs and he said, 'I could hear myself singing that.'" Flattered by his response, Billy nevertheless dismissed Maynard's words as a fraternal pat on the back and returned to his headphones, equalizers, and VU meters. But Maynard was persistent. Not only did he recognize potential in Billy's work, he saw a chance to sidestep the Tool impasse and broaden his own artistic range. "Billy had these great songs, and I asked him for a tape I could work with," he would recall. "I thought I might be able to punch them up." Maynard heard in Billy's unique sound subtle echoes of Randy Rhoads, The Cure, Susie and the Banshees, an intriguing framework for a new direction his lyrics might take. By the time he'd added vocal melodies and words, Billy's blueprint had telescoped to a three-dimensional structure of harmony and rhythm and story. Even the song Billy had believed was fully realized, an homage to a childhood mentor, Maynard recast to an impassioned screed against blind adherence to dogma. "When I heard what he did, I was just blown away," Billy would recall. "He's the master of figuring out odd puzzles." It seemed to both a foregone conclusion that they should continue their collaboration, bring in a few musicians, and see just how far their project might go. Perhaps, Maynard thought, forming a band with Billy would give him fresh perspective on the Tool standstill. "When you're in a relationship, you can't see it clearly," he would explain. "I had to look from the outside in, have another relationship to give some contrast." The two knew enough professionals to avoid the frustration of open auditions. They called in their A-list, members of bands that had opened for Tool and musicians Billy had worked with as a guitar tech. For the cost of lunch and an afternoon in a rehearsal studio, they realized a satisfying return on their investment. Players not only competent and personable, but who understood their vision for the band. Failure guitarist Troy Van Leeuwen made the cut, and Paz Linchantin, the classically trained bassist Billy had long admired. He and Maynard gave the nod to both Josh Fries of Devo and Guns N' Roses and to Tim Alexander, who would alternate on drums until one or the other became a permanent member of the group. With a handful of songs more or less completed and the fledgling band fully staffed, Maynard and Billy took the next logical, if somewhat ambitious, step. Booking shows a few months out would give them a deadline to work toward, the motivation to fine-tune their material and create a thematic, album-length body of work. Years of sharing tour buses and the Lameda House had accustomed them to each other's quirks and working style, and they tackled their job with an inspired and coordinated ferocity. Maynard reviewed Billy's music and developed melodies and lyrics, careful to retain the essence of the originals. Each iteration raised the bar for Billy, who then took the pieces to even higher levels of complexity. "I trust him," Billy said of Maynard's input. "Even when he does something and my first reaction is, huh? I let it go, I don't question it. And not because I don't want to piss him off, It's just literally that I completely trust him. Maynard's writing for Tool had been a cerebral exercise, a masculine approach of anger and attack. The night in the teepee had freed him to face his vulnerabilities head-on, to face the roots of that anger and move from the abstract to grounded, sensual lyrics. Pull me into your perfect circle. One womb, one shame, one resolve. Lyrics that defined the music's leitmotif and gave the band its name. A perfect circle would bring to the forefront Maynard's emotions, his experience, his voice. Billy had for a long time imagined the vocalist who might do justice to his music, the strong woman who would take his songs in a more feminine direction than most mainstream rock and shatter the stereotype of the fragile girl singer. But when he heard Maynard's vocal treatment of their material, he thought again. "Maynard and I were on the same page," Billy would explain. There was an unspoken understanding that a powerful sentiment could be conveyed from a feminine perspective, sung by a male. Maynard's was the voice that could best tell the APC stories, the voice that ranged effortlessly from anguished scream to tender whisper, from growling aggression to the gentle nuance often lost in Tool's wall of sound.
The argument that many people have about Tool's music is that they couldn't hear the vocals. I had to scream to be heard, and that's not necessarily a pleasant sound. It works for the rage, but it doesn't work for the art if you have to scream your head off to be heard over the amps. In a way, besides being its own band, I always thought A Perfect Circle as a way to serve Tool. I thought if my voice was more audible and people learned how to recognize it, they'd have more respect for Tool if they could hear that fourth instrument.
By the summer of 1999, concert-goers and online reviewers were already referring to APC as Maynard's side project, though he considered the new group anything but a diversion. His bands would be given the time and space each required and deserved, and that included the undertakings of his Pussifer project. In mid-August, LA's rock community turned out in force to support one of its own. Former Circle Jerks and Black Flag vocalist Keith Morris faced that summer staggering medical bills following his recent diagnosis of type 2 diabetes and a series of surgeries, and the two-show benefit was one more fundraiser Maynard could get behind. The varied lineup included Pennywise and Fishbone, Gibby Haynes of Butthole Surfers, Thelonious Monster, and actor Johnny Depp, and in the afternoon show at Whiskey A Go-Go, Recreational Racism. Maynard opened with countrified versions of Circle Jerks' Group Sex and Back Against the Wall, and then, in platinum pompadour, bushy blonde mustache, and beige leisure suit, joined Laura Milligan in Country Boner, the Libertyville campfire sing-along that had become a Recreational Racism staple. And that evening at the Viper Room, A Perfect Circle made its public debut. Maynard warned the curious audience that the sound they'd hear that night would not inspire headbanging. A Perfect Circle was AM radio music, he joked, the kind of music Billy liked. Perfect Circle allowed Maynard to be a little bit looser, Billy would explain. We bonded over humor even more than music, a dry, love of Monty Python, British, slipped-under-the-table humor. The six songs they performed that night weren't exactly easy listening, but were a delicate balance of heavy rhythms and crunching guitar riffs, atmospheric rock, and melodic intervals. New as the band was, its performance was tight, its members attuned to the other's nuances as if they'd played together for years. Percussion and bass interwove with guitar, and words of release and remorse, forgiveness and fidelity in songs so new that Maynard from time to time consulted his lyric sheet as he sang. A few days after its debut, the band played an afternoon show at the Opium Den, the new incarnation of the Gaslight, as cave dark as ever, and where water still seeped onto the stage from the men's room upstairs. The performance included the same half-dozen songs they'd done at the Viper Room, and a promise of brand new material at the Troubadour that night. Between shows, The band stopped by the backyard of Nine Inch Nails bassist Danny Lohner to join in another of Hollywood's ubiquitous cookouts. While the others passed the potato salad and sipped their Sam Adams, Maynard sat at the edge of the yard, straining to see in the fading light the lyrics he scribbled in his yellow notepad. A perfect circle made its way up the coast, opening for Fishbone or Oxbow or Dolores Hayes in tiny clubs from San Luis Obispo to San Jose to San Francisco. At each stop, the lyrics were more polished, the presentation more professional, and the gait more satisfying as word spread of this surprising alt-metal, art-rock, operatic band. The mini-tour was interrupted by APC's most well-attended performance to date. Maynard fans had looked forward for months to Tool's October 10th appearance at the inaugural Coachella Art and Music Festival in Indio, California, its first show in more than a year. But they changed their plans when they learned his new band would open the festival on the 9th. The 100-degree temperatures couldn't keep them from the Empire Polo Grounds that day, and they carried their water bottles to the mosh pit at the main stage, where they swayed in time to Billy's Les Paul and Tim's percussion and Maynard's songs of emptiness and loneliness and the healing a perfect circle of connection might bring. If audiences expected the intense, screaming frontman they'd come to know, they discovered instead a more subdued Maynard who uncharacteristically held his spot on the stage and made little eye contact with the crowd. And if they shouted his name when the band made its entrance, he shook his head and held a finger to his lips. No member of APC was more important than any other, the gesture seemed to say. The music was, after all, Billy's dream, a dream Maynard was not about to co-opt. Maynard was beyond gracious, beyond inspiring, and elevating, Billy would recall of his largesse. He can really love the underdog. He basically said, "I'm going to let you steer this ship." A Perfect Circle was an ensemble, a team, and Maynard refused to take the role of frontman or spotlit rock star, despite the message written in glitter across his t-shirt front. "Fuck me, I'm famous." The days of rummaging beneath cushions for loose change were over. Maynard's long overdue financial security meant wining and dining in style, the ingenues and fangirls eager to appear at his side, and indulging a bit in the rock star lifestyle that seemed expected of him. But he didn't put his royalties entirely toward vintage Cabernets and top-of-the-line mobile phones, gourmet cat food for his Siamese puppy cat, or Prada skunk skin blankets. He and Billy knew that maintaining artistic control of their project must come at a price. Investing their savings and their skills in the production of a demo would ensure the integrity of the singular sound that reflected their shared musical language. "Billy was influenced by things that I felt Tool would never be influenced by," Maynard would explain. "I liked the idea of bringing in some Birds melodies, some Love and Rockets. The harmonies were all Joni Mitchell." And if they recorded the demo on their own, they could be sure of its timely completion.
"I work best when you give me a puzzle and a set of parameters." Billy had been kicking around this music for a long time, and I think it motivated him for me to go, "Okay, we have exactly 5 minutes to do this." Eventually, I was going to have to get back to Tool, and I wouldn't have time to worry about anything else. So if we were going to do this, we needed to do it now. And because we just absolutely had no time, we were able to create something pure without overthinking it.
That winter, while the rest of the world prepared for the impending Y2K digital shutdown, Maynard placed his trust in Billy's Mac 9600 and his Pro Tools expertise. Renting studio space and recording to tape didn't come cheap, and going digital, they discovered, was economical and efficient. "It's the total norm nowadays," Billy explained in a 2015 interview, "but in 1999, it was extremely rare to record an album yourself." Except for an afternoon at Sound City and 2 days of percussion work at the home studio of Billy's friend Scott Humphrey, the recording and overdubbing and editing was completed in their own backyard, a room off the garage that Billy had converted to a vocal booth and recording studio. By the end of January, Mère de Nom was a reality, a collection of tales of failure and redemption, of pain born of truth, dismissed or overlooked, a chronicle of those who'd shaped Maynard's life for good or ill, their names cascading through the song titles, like a log of biblical baguettes. The two brought on board attorney Peter Paterno to guide the demo toward recording companies likely to show interest. The eye-catching cover art couldn't help but make a positive first impression, Billy's ambiguous perfect circle logo embodying the album's theme. At first glance, the mismatched arcs weren't a perfect circle at all, but with a shift in perspective, a peek behind the obvious, the image emerged of a layered symmetry, figures eclipsed in shadow, but visible all the same, if one were only to look. It was Nancy Berry's job as vice chair of EMI's Virgin Music Group Worldwide and Virgin Records America to review the demos sent her way by hopeful musicians and their reps. The rock genre was still strong in that winter of 2000, and Mère de Nom was just one more in the ever-growing stack of CDs in her inbox. But Berry's friend, Curve vocalist Tony Halliday, had inside information. Maynard and Billy had recruited Halliday's husband, producer and engineer Alan Mulder, to mix the demo, and she knew firsthand that a perfect circle was a cut above the average fledgling band. And on that rainy Sunday night in February, determined to clear her to-do list before a new work week began, Berry took her friend's advice and placed their demo in her player. "I listened to Judith and absolutely fell in love with it," Berry recalled in a 2014 interview. "I said, okay, now I've got to listen to it in the car," because that was always the test for me in signing bands. Up and down the glistening streets of Bel Air she drove, aware only of the anguished ache in Maynard's voice, of Billy's atmospheric riffs, of Paz's driving bass. Then she played the CD from start to finish, lost in the haunting eastern rhythms and dark waves of percussion, the daring segues from orchestral to goth, Maynard's plea for healing, for recognition, for peace. She pressed replay and listened again. In her years with Virgin, Berry had worked with such talents as Smashing Pumpkins and David Bowie and Janet Jackson, and her standards were high. The final mixing and mastering would come later, but already, Mère de Nom was a clean, professional production. She recognized that for all its hints of the Cocteau Twins and Swans and The Cure, for all its shifts in tempo and genre, the APC sound was in a category all its own, distinct, cohesive, and radio-friendly. First thing Monday morning, she telephoned Paterno with an offer. Berry wasn't alone in her enthusiasm. Top labels had already begun their courtship rituals, wooing Maynard and Billy with the usual lobster dinners and overpriced wines and too-good-to-be-true promises. Once more, Maynard had listened over steak and sashimi to chatter of royalty structures and distribution schemes and the band's glittering future. Accustomed by now to the seductive rhetoric, he sipped his Gewürztraminer, imagined floppy rabbit ears, and paid attention only to the practical commitments the labels might bring to the table. Virgin seemed to be a more focused company, he would recall, and 90% of the company was women, all hell-bent on proving themselves in a man's industry. And after consulting with her husband, EMI President Ken Berry, Nancy sweetened her offer with terms that tipped the scales towards Virgin even more. "She got us a joint venture deal, which most labels weren't willing to do," Maynard would explain. "We'd be business partners. The band would invest in promotions and marketing, and we'd split the profits 50-50 with the label." With only 2 months to prepare before APC was to go on the road, Berry made the band a Virgin priority. "I've never in my career done anything as fast and intense as we did for Perfect Circle," she would recall. The final mastering of Mère de Nom must be completed, and a music video, the marketing campaign, and the design of elaborate sets in time for the band to open for Nine Inch Nails in its Fragility version 2.0 tour that would begin in April.
Nancy Berry managed to wrangle David Fincher to direct the Judith video, which is a gorgeous piece and really did a lot for us. I'm sure dealing with someone like me wasn't anything out of the ordinary for him, but of course, we butted heads a little. We had to negotiate and compromise between him wanting to see my face and me wanting to be Cousin It behind the wig. We managed to find a happy medium, and in the course of filming, he expressed interest in having me possibly read for his next film. Legend has it that I was booked for it and turned it down, but no. I had to get to work and go on the road. Dwight Yoakam ended up playing the role. There was no possible way I would have pulled off what he did in Panic Room. So that was probably the best decision Fincher ever made, not to pursue having me read for the part.
Searchlights and strobes illuminated the twin arcs and the rune-like renderings of Mère de Nom song titles suspended over the darkened stage. Louder and louder against the crowd's expectant cheers rose Josh's staccato percussion, Billy's wailing guitar, Pause's crashing bass, Troy's insistent rhythms. The music slowed, then expanded, then erupted in sonic chaos. Through the Midwest, across Canada, up the East Coast, mosh pits exploded in a blur of slamming and crowd surfing. APC, audiences discovered, was a symphonic pop metal fusion, a balance of grunge and rock, a celebration of the unexpected, an erotic strip poker intro, a 10-minute mashup of Ozzy Osbourne's Diary of a Madman sung over The Cure's love song, Maynard's frenzied burlesque of self-stimulation. He and his bandmates communicated cues with no more than a glance, their sensitivity belying their brief partnership. The APC members were mysterious characters in black, their costumes a shadowy camouflage that allowed their stories to take center stage, the tales of dismissal and heartbreak, of rage and introspection and forgiveness. Maynard growled and crooned and raged Billy's lyrics and his own, lyrics of how much was lost in the blind surrender to love, how much gained in authentic connection, how much destroyed in unquestioned faith in a specious savior. He hunched and crouched and convulsed across the stage, twisted his bare torso and jerked his head, and the long hair of his wig fell across his eyes. Barry wasn't unnerved by Maynard's insistence on the wig. He'd explained to her the importance of differentiating his APC persona and of walking about unrecognized with his son. "Whenever something was deeply personal to an artist, I tried to understand it and appreciate it," she would explain, and he really wanted APC to be seen as a unit, not just as Maynard. He's a reluctant rock star. Adamant as Maynard was about stepping from the frontman role, his name undeniably drew the curious public to APC. But they paid attention because of the music. Released on May 23, 2000, Mère de Nom entered the Billboard 200 at number 4, higher than any previous ranking of a rock band's debut album. The record sold more than 188,000 copies in its first week and would remain on the charts for just short of a year. Mère de Nom was a group of people coming together at the right time, Barry would explain. It was the perfect combination of the talent, the look, the personalities, and Maynard brought something else with his theatricality, the sensitivity of his voice, something intellectual and dreamy with the lyrics. Even so, fans who didn't know the backstory of the volcano impasse perceived APC as Maynard's abandonment of Tool. They posted on message boards and online forums their disappointment in his desertion and their demand that he return to the only band that really mattered. But reviewers and critics recognized in Mère de Nom more than a flash-in-the-pan side project. Steve Morse, in his coverage of the May 2nd show at the Worcester Centrum in Massachusetts, reported that while the jury was still out on some of its songs, a perfect circle appeared to have a can't-miss future in the marketplace. And far from a trivial pastime, APC was Maynard's opportunity to exercise his marketing savvy and meet the challenge of a music industry in flux. In the wake of a changing business model, mega record stores had begun to give way to online retailers and music sharing sites like Napster, sites that might or might not compensate artists for downloads of their work. Touring was where the money was, and the joint venture meant that in exchange for bankrolling the cross-country road trip, the band would reap 100% of tour profits and drive CD sales along the way.
Billboards and magazine articles and radio play would never generate enough sales. We had to get in front of people and stay on the road long enough to build awareness. I'd learned that the best way to do this was to play a city and circle back a couple more times. That creates 3 points of reference for people to remember, and that costs money. Whenever you can figure out some way to cross-promote things, it helps. If you can partner with friends with successful businesses, at least it doesn't feel like you're selling out. You feel good because you believe in what you're doing, and everybody wins.
Maynard had worn the Oakley sunglasses marketed by Tim Caliente since 1995 and was well aware that his celebrity had boosted sales. Involving Caliente in promoting APC would create a mobile chewbone pickup, increasing sales of one product via awareness of another. "Maynard came to me," Caliente would recall. "He said, 'Hey, I've got this new band and we need tour support. What can you do for us?'" It was simple. I'd get companies to wrap the tour bus. Caliente would enshroud the APC bus in oversized vinyl sheets printed with colorful advertisements for Oakley sunglasses and goggles and Paul Frank tees and tote bags. The band's share of the revenue would enable APC to extend its tour, compensate the crew, obtain even more spotlights and gels. Bus wraps were virtually unheard of in the States, despite their popularity in Europe, but Maynard understood the potential impact of such a blend of the artistic and practical. "Maynard's always had that ability to separate himself from what other people are doing," Caliente would explain. "Everything he does, he's a step ahead of everybody else." The 2-month Nine Inch Nails tour was followed by appearances at the Fuji Festival and Canada's Somersault Festival, and with few breaks, 8 months of headlining sold-out shows in Australia, Europe, and the U.S. And at every stop, from Sydney to Stuttgart, from Saskatoon to Sacramento, to the Grand Rapids Deltaplex, Maynard paused between songs and reminded the crowd that the force behind the music, the mastermind of a perfect circle, was Billy. "It says a lot about Maynard that he didn't just insert himself," Billy would explain. "In every photo shoot, he said, 'No, put Billy up front, it's his band.' He was very clear about the fact that I had done the work ahead of time. He appreciates and demands hard work. The last thing he wants is a lottery winner who got there by happenstance." Nor would Maynard allow himself to coast, to amble when a concerted sprint was required. If anything, the breakneck recording pace and nonstop tour fueled his imperative to take advantage of every spare moment to imagine, to write, to compose. And when Devo expressed an interest in making music of his own, Maynard wasn't one to discourage him. "I'd heard Paz's sister Anna practicing her cello, and I was absolutely enamored," Devo would recall in a 2015 interview. "A few years later, Dad gave me my cello. He's always been encouraging and excited about my playing." From Portland to Pensacola to Pittsburgh, while his bandmates read or rested or reviewed the next night's set list, Maynard curled in a quiet spot at the back of the bus and worked on the songs Tool fans had impatiently awaited for nearly 4 years.